Take back the city for yourself tonight. I'll take back the city for me. Take back the city for yourself tonight. Whoa, whoa.
Welcome to Third Paradigm, an out-of-the-box think tank about community sovereignty and regenerative economics. We look at how to take back our cities, farmland, and water, our money, production, and trade, our media, education, and culture, our religion, and even our God. We present a people's history of the Bible and a parent's view on how to raise giving kids in a taking world. I'm your host, Teresa Caraggio, broadcasting through Free Radio Santa Cruz, WHCL Hamilton College, Radio Lillooet, British Columbia, and Upstart Radio Online. I love this place enough to have no doubt. Whoa, whoa. Welcome to the 42nd episode of Third Paradigm, entitled You've Been Framed. This week, we'll look at how public opinion can be manipulated by the way that the question is phrased. This might be comparable to taking a painting and putting a wide red frame over it that obscures half the picture and highlights what's red within it. If asked what it's a picture of, the viewer will name the red object. As color analysts know, even the names of colors change, depending on what color they're next to. The eye will push adjacent colors away to create greater contrast. Beige is called pink next to green and labeled green next to red. So even a fixed color shifts inside our eye as the cones and rods align to accentuate differences. In the same way, how a question is worded will shift the perspective of the listener. It will put parameters on how much of the context is included and create contrast and complementary points that change how the facts are colored. Framing draws our mental eye to some details and causes us to brush over others. Derek Jensen talks about studies showing that people won't see what contradicts their belief system, even when it's right in front of them. The eye won't track over it. The peripheral vision will register it and keep the iris averted. So what you see, what you get in a cognitive sense, is what you see. If we want to understand the truth of an issue, we need to first look it in the frame. By understanding the frame, we can begin to dismantle it. Then we can put it in the larger context and get the perspective straight. The first example we'll apply this to is Mark Hosenball, special correspondent for Newsweek, who was on NPR's Talk of the Nation chatting about the Inspector General's report on the use of torture. We'll take one paragraph and do an analysis on it, a la the Media Watch Group FAIR, or Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting. Second, the London-based group Survival International has found the winner for their most racist article of the year award. And the prize goes to an editorial in Peru's daily, El Correo, which suggests bombing the Peruvian natives with napalm. We'll update you on the indigenous situation in Peru and the media war against it. But Glenn Beck, Fox News, Ann Coulter, Sean Hannity, and Bill O'Reilly will certainly be disappointed that their coverage of Van Jones as a radical extremist didn't qualify. As a consolation prize, we'll check some of their facts, or lack thereof. But first, let's read a poem about the difference between seeing and perspective. Monet Refuses the Operation by Liesl Mueller. The music is Autumn Project with This We Take With Us. Doctor, you say that there are no halos around the streetlights in Paris. And what I see is an aberration caused by old age, an affliction. I tell you, it has taken me all my life to arrive at the vision of gas lamps as angels, to soften and blur and finally banish the edges you regret I don't see. To learn that the line I called the horizon does not exist, and sky and water, so long apart, are the same state of being. 54 years before I could see, Rouen Cathedral is built of parallel shafts of sun. And now you want to restore my youthful errors, fixed notions of top and bottom, the illusion of three-dimensional space, wisteria separate from the bridge it covers. What can I say to convince you the Houses of Parliament dissolve night after night to become the fluid dream of the Thames? I will not return to a universe of objects that don't know each other, as if islands were not the lost children of one great continent. The world is flux, and light becomes what it touches, becomes water, lilies on water, above and below water, becomes lilac and mauve and yellow and white and cerulean lamps, small fists passing sunlight so quickly to one another that it would take long streaming hair inside my brush to catch it. To paint the speed of light, our weighted shapes, these verticals, burn to mix with air and changes our bones, skin, clothes to gases. Doctor, if only you could see how heaven pulls earth into its arms and how infinitely the heart expands to claim this world, blue vapor without end. That was Monet Refuses the Operation by Liesl Mueller from 60 Years of American Poetry. The music was This We Take With Us, Song 2 from the Autumn Project. This is one of my favorite poems. Mueller describes how the world Monet paints dissolves the frame around reality. For all of my school years before college, I had glasses that I inexplicably refused to wear. Instead, I'd cringe when the nuns had us read from the overhead projector out loud. Since my last name began with a Z, I could rehearse my scolding 29 times before she got to me. Since I couldn't see the board, I never knew what the homework was, and spent my formative years with my desk out in the hallway. In sports, I couldn't even see the ball. Socially, I couldn't recognize people from more than a 2-foot distance, and so walked with my nose in a book. Certainly, my awkwardness and ineptitude can't all be blamed on myopia, but it didn't help. On the other hand, it probably made me who I am. To me, the world was an impressionistic painting. The exterior reality was soft, fuzzy, and didn't intrude on my interior life. Mike Sirocco, who's blazing through the website design, said I reminded him of a display of tempered glass he saw when he was 10. They applied ice to one side and a blowtorch to the other, and it didn't crack. I'm not ready for the experiment, but I do have a higher tolerance for conflict than most people. That early sense of detachment has served me well. However, by college I had gotten contacts and found that there were spaces between the leaves and a dark side of the moon. But I could still retreat when the world was too much with me. 8 years ago, I had the operation that Monet refused. All I have to say is that relentless clarity with teenagers is enough to drive a person to drink. But where Monet dissolves Parliament into the fluid dream of the Thames, what passes as journalism today dissolves our heads like the sugar cube people. Let's read the excerpt from Talk of the Nation. This is Mark Hosenball, Special Investigative Correspondent for Newsweek, on the then-pending report from the Inspector General. The emphasis is mine. Well, we're going to learn some more details about alleged abuses in the CIA detention and interrogation program, including, as I understand it, some allegation to the effect that at least one detainee, this guy Nashiri, alleged mastermind of the coal bombing, was somehow threatened that his family members would be abused or raped or whatever, and also that Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, the alleged mastermind, or I guess the confessed mastermind of the 9/11 attacks, that he was threatened that families of his members of his family would be killed and a part of if he didn't cooperate with the CIA. So there's, and we reported last Friday, my colleague Mike Isikoff and myself in Newsweek, that the report is also going to allege that the CIA conducted mock executions of some of these detainees to frighten them. And this man, Nashiri, the coal bomber, was threatened with a gun and a power drill. They held up the power drill in front of him and went, with it. The implication being they would use it on him if he didn't talk. These are all pressure tactics, tactics designed to threaten these people, in the case of the mock executions, with imminent death. And such tactics are forbidden under both international conventions against torture and American law forbidding torture. So these are allegations essentially that the CIA, or CIA people, you know, broke the law by going beyond guidelines, which are pretty flexible guidelines anyway, laid down by the Bush Justice Department in the way they conducted these interrogations. Now, in my copy, I've highlighted all of the places where he adds phrases and words that color how we hear the facts. I'll now reread the same passage without them. We're going to learn more details about abuses in the CIA detention and interrogation program. One detainee, Nashiri, was threatened that his family members would be abused or raped. Khalid Sheikh Mohammed was threatened that members of his family would be killed if he didn't cooperate with the CIA. The CIA conducted mock executions of detainees. Nashiri was threatened with a gun and a power drill they would use on him if he didn't talk. These are tactics designed to threaten people with imminent death. Such tactics are forbidden under international conventions against torture and under American law forbidding torture. So the CIA, within the Bush Justice Department guidelines, broke the law by the way that they conducted these interrogations. See the difference? By taking out over half the words, you get the facts. Of the extra 150 words, 6 are alleged or allegation. The one making allegations, however, is the Inspector General, whose job, like Hosenball's as an investigative reporter, is supposed to be to inspect and report the facts so others can determine the truth. The word alleged is applied with a wink to the detainees and later dropped. Khalid Sheikh Mohammed goes from alleged to, I guess, the confessed mastermind of the 9/11 attacks. The confession reverse justifies the torture, rather than the torture negating the confession. Nashiri is first alleged and then becomes the coal bomber, as his guilt is assumed. They're called masterminds, making them larger-than-life villains and invoking images of Dr. Evil. They're also referred to as this guy, these people, and this man, words that position them as other, unlike you or me. The most disturbing transition, however, is when Hosenball makes light of threatening to rape their loved ones. Does Hosenball have a wife? A daughter? Would he refer to their rape as whatever? And then to imitate the sound of a power drill. Are we on a playground here? How can someone with such an, ooh, did we scare you, adolescent horror movie approach call themselves an investigative reporter? For some real reporting, let's listen to the Onion News Network with who should be held accountable for Minotaur May's interrogations.
I'm Juliana McCannis, filling in for Clifford Baines, who is vacuuming. This week, the military began closing the controversial labyrinth, which for 7 years housed the brutal Minotaur they used to interrogate terror suspects. But Congress and the American people are still demanding to know who will be held accountable for authorizing the Minotaur maze.
Well, I can tell you that right now. No one should be held accountable because the use of the Minotaur was necessary.
Yeah, so forcing prisoners to wander in an infinite labyrinth, living in fear of being torn limb from limb by the Minotaur, may seem harsh to some people now, but you have to remember what it it was like after 9/11.
That flesh-hungry half-man, half-bull kept us safe from the terrorists.
Look, recently released classified memos show that many of the suspects held at this facility suffered serious psychological damage because of the labyrinth's constantly shifting walls, not to mention the dozens who had their spines added to the Minotaur's spine pile.
Look, I work for the Bush administration, and this is the fault of the media. They have blown this whole Minotaur issue out of proportion. Oh. For one thing, the Minotaur is only 11 feet tall, not 20 like is commonly reported.
It doesn't whether the Minotaur used one razor-sharp axe or seven.
Jason, look, the terrorists would do a lot worse to you. They'd drag you up the side of a mountain and have your bowels pecked out by griffins.
We could use griffins, but we don't use griffins. And I think that's what separates us from them.
That's exactly right.
The Obama administration has released some photos of these etchings, which were found carved on the labyrinth walls.
I mean, I don't see what the debate is here. These etchings clearly prove that the interrogations constituted torture.
They still prove anything.
No, that's right. And even if the Minotaur did act inappropriately, and I'm not saying it did, the United States cannot be held responsible for its actions because it is a beastly Minotaur and no chains can bind it.
And, you know, frankly, I think it's sad that now the words never-ending labyrinth of pain are synonymous with the errors made by one loose cannon Minotaur admittedly went too far.
I mean, the fact is that this maze violates the Geneva Convention, which prohibits the use of any bovine monster who wields an axe and has teeth longer than 9 inches.
It doesn't make sense. Every terrorist out there is now going to be trained on how to resist talking to a Minotaur while he disembowels him with his razor-sharp arms.
Yeah, now you want to tie the hands and hooves of our interrogators
even
further?
There's got to be a federal investigation
Well,
here.
The Minotaur himself has some interesting suggestions on the topic in his new tell-all audiobook.
I believe we have a clip from the controversial section where the Minotaur talks about Dick Cheney's personal involvement in building the maze.
It's completely unsubstantiated.
That was the incomparable Onion News Network with who should be held accountable for Minotaur maze interrogations. Now let's look at the Most Racist Article of the Year award. It's part of Survival's Stamp It Out campaign, which aims to challenge racist descriptions of indigenous peoples in the world's media. The winner receives an inscribed quotation from Lakota Sioux Luther Standing Bear, which is, "All the years of calling the Indian a savage has never made him one." The illustrious winner, Aldo Maria Tegu, is the director and columnist for Peru's daily El Correo. Incidentally, he also once labeled my friend David Bayer an information terrorist for his work on how agro exports like asparagus and grapes have precipitously dropped the water table, leading to imminent drought. Information as a form of terrorism makes the war on terror a war on information. In his recent column, Maria Tegu refers to Amazon natives as savages, Paleolithic, and primitive, and writes that in protests that have recently engulfed much of Peru's Amazon, they were manipulated by communist excrement. For those of you, he says, who still think of these ethnic groups as good, naive, and pure, I will remind you that it was these same people who perfected the art of shrinking the heads of their enemies and wearing them on the belts holding up their loincloths, wrote Maria Tegu. If the natives didn't shrink the heads of the policemen they killed and eat their remains, it was only because there wasn't time. He concluded by adding, "I don't know what keeps the president from providing the Air Force with all the napalm necessary." My student group, Food in the Hood, continues to raise money for the indigenous Peruvians who were attacked in the Bagua massacre. They had been peacefully protesting for 56 days against the U.S.-Peru Free Trade Agreement, which zones 70% of the Amazon for oil and gas exploration. Without provocation, Garcia authorized police to open fire on crowds of 5,000. Photos show armored tanks rolling towards women, children, and men with no weapons other than their traditional spears. Notable in Maria Tegu's framing is that communist excrement is the outside influence that's manipulated them. The foreign investment that paid for the soldiers, guns, and tanks aren't considered an outside influence. A Lima judge has demanded that Interpol return the indigenous leaders from Nicaragua, where they've sought asylum. This includes Alberto Pinzongo, who had been negotiating with the government over mining concessions before the attack, and Teresita Atazu, president of the Union of Ashaninka and Lanizea nationalities, who's charged with sedition and rebellion. Going back to the concept of framing, what does sedition and rebellion mean when you're a plurinational group, negotiating with a government that's broken both its own and international law. Now let's look at the hubbub over that radical green extremist, Van Jones. But Glenn Beck is too easy of a target. You just have to aim your logic anywhere in his vicinity. I'd like instead to critique Van Jones' defenders. Here's Ryan Witz, Political Buzz Examiner. He's talking about Van Jones' signature on the 9/11 Truth petition. Quote, "Let me say first, I believe the 9/11 Truth Organization's theories are bogus. I have seen various documentaries on the alleged conspiracy theory and read some of the organization's material. In the end, I was unconvinced that our government was that evil to allow or perpetrate an attack. Like many conspiracy theories, i.e. birthers, their argument, I find, relies mostly on the lack of evidence from the other side rather than any hard evidence they have themselves. Finally, I cannot believe that our government could cover up such a grand conspiracy under the nose of the public and press. Call me naive if you wish. I will call myself reasonable. I do not believe Van Jones should have signed the petition. In the end, I think this is more a sign of stupidity than any evil intentions by Van Jones." Santa Cruz's own Ocean Robbins cites this article while petitioning supporters to stand up for Obama's Green Jobs advisor. Should we make buttons that say, "Van Jones, stupid but not evil"? Why aren't we using this to intensify the call for some real answers on 9/11? Let's look at the substance behind the arguments Witt uses to refute the documentaries he says he's seen. I've highlighted them in red in my copy. He says, first, they're bogus because I believe they're bogus. Second, I was unconvinced. Third, our government couldn't be that evil. Fourth, the other side's lack of evidence doesn't prove anything. Fifth, I can't believe they could get away with it. Six, I say I'm reasonable. Seven, he just shouldn't have signed. Eight, it was stupid, but not evil. Is that a backhanded compliment or what? Is Ryan Witt's word enough to make you ignore the evidence of your own mind and eyes? Steel-structured buildings don't collapse at free-fall speed. But I wouldn't have been able to see this obvious thing in front of me without the mountain of evidence presented by Richard Gage, founder of Architects and Engineers for 9/11 Truth. It's hard to see what contradicts your whole belief system, as Derek Jensen points out. But the evidence is irrefutable and unrefuted, and not, as Witt says, because it's too ridiculous to answer. For more information, check out the episode called Making a Killing in the archives at radioforall.net with the bonus interview of Richard Gage. In Glenn Beck's own words, "Among all the radical progressive communist nonsense coming from Obama's green job czar, you can now add, thinks the Bush administration blew up the World Trade Center and covered it up." He goes on to say, "If you believe that about your government, forget about the green jobs. Wouldn't you want to find out who in our government was trying to kill innocent Americans, 3,000 innocent Americans? Wouldn't that be a top priority?" For once, I think we should listen to Glenn Beck. Now that Van Jones has been heckled out of green jobs, let's support him in becoming the highest-profile spokesperson the 9/11 Truth Movement ever had. As Obama says, if those who perpetrated 9/11 get away with it, they'll do it again. Don't we need to know who the villains were? A homicide investigation of just one person would have been conducted more thoroughly than this crime has been. Refuse to cave to those who ridicule the questions in order to intimidate us out of asking them. Let's make this our first priority. This has been Teresa Caraggio for Third Paradigm. A million thanks to Mike Sirocco, who's apologized to me for how fast he's pulling together the website. I barely send off one round of instructions before it's done with a new set of questions and patient explanations back to me. It's still in lorem ipsum stage, but if you want to check out the insane rate of progress in a week, go to thirdparadigm.org. Thanks as always to my co-conspirator, Skidmark Bob, for music production and editing. Our last song is from my new favorite CD, We Sing, We Dance, We Steal Things. It's Jason Mraz with Make It Mine.
Wake up, everyone. How can you sleep at a time like this unless the dreamer is the real you? Listen to your voice, the one that tells you to taste past the tip of your tongue. Leap in the net will appear. I don't want to wait before the dream is over. Requesting that it's lifting you up, up, up and away, and over to a table at the Gratitude Cafe. And I am finally there, and all the angels, they'll be singing a la 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 la. Well, I don't wanna break. Don't wanna wait.